On today's episode of Mentally Stronger.
I have a mission, which is to end cognitive decline. We have 6 million Americans with Alzheimer's disease. We have 50 million people worldwide with Alzheimer's disease. That number is going to triple by the year 2050. And Amy, it is a preventable disease. We shouldn't be getting it. So we have lifestyle interventions that can help slow the progression of this disease. And one of them is exercise. And I have to tell you, it is the best intervention out of all of the interventions. It far outweighs nutritional interventions. In my opinion, it doesn't outweigh sleep, but it really couples sleep. So if you can get exercise right, you really have a chance of aging well and aging better and longer. So the guidelines, the physical activity guidelines, state that we should be doing at least.
Welcome to Mentally Stronger, the show that will help you develop the mental strength you need to reach your greatest potential, no matter what life throws your way. I'm Amy Morin, a psychotherapist, mental strength trainer, and an international best-selling author of 6 books on mental strength. Every Monday, I introduce you to a guest whose story and expertise can inspire you to think, feel, and do your best in life. And the fun part is, we record it all from a sailboat in the Florida Keys. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Clearly, your physical health and your mental health are intertwined. And building physical strength is a really good way to build mental strength. Movement will help you build mental strength in several ways. Everything from increasing the blood flow to your brain to releasing neurotransmitters that help you feel good. Exercise is a great way to train your brain to see that you can do more than you think. Because when you're running or you're lifting heavy weights, your brain is going to tell you to quit long before you actually need to quit. And you can teach your brain that you can keep going even when you feel tired, to prove to your brain that you're stronger than you think. But that's not the only way that exercise helps us grow mentally stronger. Here to give us more details about the benefits of mental health and physical exercise is neurophysiologist Louisa Nicola. She's the founder of NeuroAthletics, and she works with top athletes in the NBA and the NFL. She also works with finance professionals who want to learn how to perform at their best. She's also the host of the Neuro Experience podcast. Some of the things she talks about today are how physical activity impacts our brains, the kinds of exercises we should do for optimal mental health, and how much exercise we really need. Whether you're already active or you know that you could benefit from moving around a little bit more, stay tuned. I think you'll learn something. So here's Louisa Nicola on how exercise affects our mental health. Louisa Nicola, welcome to Mentally Stronger.
Hi, Amy. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you too and to dive into exercise and how it affects our mental health and our brains. But maybe the best place to start is to ask, what exactly is a neurophysiologist?
I love getting that asked that question. So neurophysiology is a subspecialty of neurology. So a neurophysiologist, well, this is evidently in Australia, but it is worldwide. You would either see them in the operating room, which is where I was clinically based. So operating room, mainly working with craniotomies and scoliosis surgeries. And what we are primarily, I would say what we're really well known for is, have you ever seen a lab where maybe somebody has epilepsy, you go in, you wear one of those caps and they've got leads coming off them? That's called an EEG. You'd usually see a neurophysiologist who can interpret data from somebody who's had epilepsy, or maybe they're doing a nerve conduction study to pick up on something like multiple sclerosis or myasthenia gravis. So it's a subspecialty of neurology.
And what exactly is it that you're doing to help people? I know you work with athletes and investors and lots of interesting people.
So when I was specifically trained and I've done like 15 years of schooling and training, I realized that first and foremost, the brain is responsible for absolutely everything we do. And it was when in clinical practice, when I was looking at these EEG scans, which is looking at the functioning of the brain, how well a person's brain is functioning or malfunctioning, if you will, because if you have epilepsy, something's going wrong there. So I did like 1,000 of these scans and I was thinking to myself, imagine if we were scanning the brains of just everyday people and just making them better, you know, just average people and making them more elite. So that's where I started. And that was back in, I think, 2019 when I quit clinical practice. And then I just started scanning brains of elite athletes, mainly NBA players, NFL players, which was fascinating because they get a lot of concussions, and also high-level executives on Wall Street. And I was finding that a lot of these brains, you know, when you look at a brain, it's you don't see the person, you just see that brain, right? And you would see, you know, their date of birth, and you'd see, okay, great, this man is 42 years old, but his brain is coming back as a 69-year-old brain because you put it against a normative database where you see millions of brains and it basically says, okay, this man is 69, but he's not 69. He's actually 42 chronologically. So that's when I started thinking, huh, it was around 2019. I thought, okay, there's something to this. There's average people who are going out there and working and they can be even better because their brain can be performing better. So right now, my company, Neuro Athletics, we have two sides. We coach coaches on what we know, but we also work with high-level executives to basically get them from average to elite.
And is the goal just to make your brain essentially younger, or are there other things that we're working on?
No, the goal is to get you to perform better. So we don't just do, you know, the brain workup, if you will, and work in that aspect. We're doing everything from VO2 max testing. We're doing muscle fiber testing. We're doing like comprehensive blood work. We're doing DEXA scans. We're literally looking at around 7,000 different data points in an individual, figuring out what are their constraints, like what's holding them back from being elite. So your physiological peak, Amy, is different to mine because we are completely different, different DNA, different blood biomarkers, et cetera. So I would look at you, I would get 7,000 different data points from you, and then I would figure out, okay, out of 100, which would be your peak, you're operating at maybe a 75. That's just, you know, I'm not saying you are, but you know, maybe you're operating at 75. Mm-hmm. So what can we change to get you to operate at 100% of your peak?
So what are some examples then of things that you might have somebody change or tweak so that they could become better?
Well, a really prime example is one that I love so much is blood work. So easy to go and get blood work done, right? Anyone can take your blood, but it takes someone really special to analyze your blood work. And let's just say, for example, you are a human. You should be waking up every single day thriving with energy, with motivation, with high libido. Anything less than that means that you are not quote unquote healthy. I think we've missed the ball game right now. In 2024, people think they're healthy because they have an absence of disease. I hear it every day. Oh, I'm completely healthy. I went to the doctor. I'm not dying. It's like, okay, great. But if you take something as small as a vitamin D deficiency, which I honestly think almost every person in the United States, I know it's a very high percentage, but a lot of people have vitamin D deficiency. You would think, okay, great. I just need to go out in the sun. Maybe I need to take a vitamin D supplement. But vitamin D is more than just a vitamin. It's a hormone and it's responsible for so much. And it's also a precursor to other hormones that are responsible for energy, vitality, reproduction, bone health. So just taking that one tiny biomarker, which is vitamin D deficiency, I would figure out, A, why are you vitamin D deficient? And B, what do we have to do to get you to a, you know, 60 rather than being at a 20? There could be another, you know, a zinc deficiency. Women who have zinc deficiencies will find it hard to lose weight. So just supplementing and getting your zinc, maybe if you're taking 600 milligrams of zinc per day, that may mean that you can eat an extra 1,000 calories per day. So many different things that we could tweak.
Wow, that's amazing just to think that those little things could make such a difference. And there aren't a lot of people talking about it. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that you're talking about how to become better and peak performance too. I talk about mental strength. I'm not here just talking about mental illness. I'm talking about how do you get to the next level, regardless of whether you're struggling with something related to mental health. Are there tests people should be asking their doctor to run, things they should be asking their doctor to do?
Yeah. And that brings me to my next point. A lot of practitioners will not give you this comprehensive blood work because doctors are there just to make sure that you are alive today. And there are these recommended ranges for blood work that I don't necessarily agree with, and anybody in this space would not necessarily agree with. For example, you'll go to your doctor and do a lipid panel. You would assess your triglycerides, your cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, et cetera. And they will tell you that if you have an LDL reading, this is in the United States, of 105 or 110, they'll say that's okay. But what we don't realize, and this is because we're not trained, you know, the regular person isn't trained in this, and doctors also don't really care about this. They're pretty much basing your lipid panel on the on population norms. The population in America is obese, sick, and becoming extremely infertile. So you don't want to be basing your blood biomarkers on that population. You want to be looking at performance biomarkers. So the American Heart Association wants you to have a below 100 reading for LDL. I want you to have a below 80 reading for LDL. So if you are going to your PCP, some of the things that you want to ask for, which are not generally put in there, is an ApoB, which is a more predictive risk factor of cardiovascular disease. You want to check LP little a, which is another lipoprotein, which is a genetic risk factor, an inherited genetic risk factor for cardiovascular disease. ASCVD is one of the leading causes of death in the United States. So you really want to get on top of it and make sure that you've got, you know, great artery health. So why wouldn't you be asking a doctor for that?
And if you ask your doctor those things, will the average primary care physician say yes to that?
Probably not. Depends on who you go to. You can push them. It might not, you might have to pay out of pocket for them. And then they may even tell you, oh, it's not needed, but you can push for it. And if you can't, go to a new practitioner.
Wise advice.
Yeah.
For somebody who says, all right, maybe I'm going to get some tests done, that sort of a thing. I'm not going to dive really deep in this. I'm not an elite athlete. I'm just somebody who wants to feel good. Let's talk about exercise. Mm. What do we usually get wrong about exercise? Let's start there.
Let's start with exercise because this is my primary area of research. I have a really wonderful review article coming out now that's taken me over 6 months to write. And it's all based on the latest findings of exercise and mild cognitive impairment. So I have a mission, which is to end cognitive decline. We have 6 million Americans with Alzheimer's disease. We have 50 million people worldwide with Alzheimer's disease. That number is going to triple by the year 2050. And Amy, it is a preventable disease. We shouldn't be getting it. So we have lifestyle interventions that can help slow the progression of this disease. And one of them is exercise. And I have to tell you, it is the best intervention out of all of the interventions. It far outweighs nutritional interventions. In my opinion, it doesn't outweigh sleep, but it really couples sleep. So if you can get exercise right, you really have a chance of aging well and aging better and longer. So the guidelines, the physical activity guidelines, state that we should be doing at least 150 minutes to 300 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity a week. My biggest hate, first and foremost, before we get into this, is the word physical activity. Because it blindsides people. And I'll give my mother, my poor mom, I bring her up in every podcast because she's one of these people who will hear this and say to me, Louisa, I did exercise today. I did my washing. You know, she does the washing. She's running around for my dad. She goes and does the mail. She considers that her exercise. But of course she does because the nomenclature is physical activity. So we need to change that, right? Physical activity is literally me walking to the fridge and back. So we want to be exercising. And I would change the recommendations to be doing at least minimum 300 minutes of aerobic physical activity per week and at least 4 sessions of resistance training per week.
Let's take a second so I can share some offers from our sponsors. Brainstorm. What's something that works so well that it's basically magic? Air conditioning? Noise-canceling headphones, meeting-free Fridays. What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the did we just hit $1 million stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/mentally stronger, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/mentally stronger now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/mentally stronger. Okay, we're back. Okay, so 300 minutes of cardio.
Mm-hmm.
And four strength training sessions.
Yes. Let's separate the two right now, right? Let's talk about what they are and why they're beneficial. So when we're doing aerobic-based physical activity, let's say we're working at around 65% of our maximum heart rate. You can work that out. Let's just say your maximum heart rate is 200, for example. So you want to be working at around 65% of your maximum heart rate. This does amazing things for your brain and your body. And you have to think about it as your organs survive with blood. That's, you know, you have to deliver blood to your brain and to all the organs for them to function. Blood delivers oxygen and nutrients. Therefore, the more blood that you pump to these vital organs, the healthier they are, the more oxygen they get, the more nutrients they get. When you exercise aerobic-based activity, you're sending more blood, which is more nutrients, more oxygen to these organs. What you're also doing is, when it comes to the brain, aerobic physical activity, when you engage in it, you release a really great neurotropin, if you will, or hormone. We can call it many different things. It's called BDNF, and it's brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It is a growth factor for the brain. It basically helps the neurons, which are the brain cells. We've got around 86 billion of them. It helps them grow and survive. It helps them make new connections with each other, which we want, right? Because as we age, these connections die. As we age, the neurons die. They atrophy, they get smaller, they deteriorate. It's normal. But there's one specific area, Amy, in the brain. It's deep in the temporal lobes, which sit just behind the ear. You go deep inside there. It's called the hippocampus. It's a seahorse-shaped structure. It's involved in memories, formation. It is literally, I believe, it's the seat of our soul. I've never said that on a podcast before, but you know, I've been delving into Alzheimer's disease today and like what it actually means for a person. You literally lose yourself. This is what it's the only disease where you lose who you are. Some, you know, if you've really seen end stages of Alzheimer's disease, it's really sad because people are like, who am I? You'll say, hi, Julie. And they'll say, who's Julie? And that's right. Really scary. So this hippocampus is the first, you know, it's the first thing to go and shrink during these disease states. So BDNF goes in and you can actually grow the hippocampus, so more volume, and it can actually grow new neurons in that hippocampus. So you can hold on to who you are and the memories of who you are. So aerobic physical activity is not just great, it is absolutely needed and it's mandatory for the healthy functioning of your brain.
Well, that's powerful stuff. So for somebody who says, I have no idea what my heart rate is, does a smartwatch do it when you have a smartwatch and you can mm-hmm. check it? Is that actually accurate enough to work?
Absolutely. And you don't even have to get so like deep in the weeds, like neuroathletics, when we bring on a new client, we go like, we test their VO2 max, we're putting heart rate monitor, we're going really deep, but you don't have to do that. You can literally just get your age and minus it. If you do 220 minus your age, you'll get your maximum heart rate. That's your maximum. And then work as a 65% of that number. And that's where you need to be.
How long do you want to stay in that zone?
I mean, I call it zone two. A really great way of measuring this is the talk test. You want to be, just say you're on a treadmill, you're running or you're walking up a hill. You want to be able to feel it, like you're huffing and puffing, but you also want to have a conversation. That's when you know you're pretty much in zone two. I would want you to be there for an hour at a time. And that's not broken up in 20-minute segments. I want you there, if you're going to commit to it, do at least an hour. at one time.
So I see a lot of people talking about physical health and activity. There's so much conflicting advice out there. And one of the things I hear from some people is if you do that, if you stay in an increased state with your heart rate up for an hour, then your body releases all of these stress hormones and then you're going to struggle to lose weight. I see this on Instagram and all over the internet all the time. What can you say about that?
Well, first of all, stop following these people. That's the first thing. Second thing is adaptation is a really beautiful thing. The only way that we get anywhere in life is by placing stress upon a system. When we place stress upon a system, we adapt to it. And that's the only way we get fitter. So of course, you're going to release all of these cortisol and stress hormones and cytokines and IL-6 and IL-1B. We need these things because if you don't, then what are you doing at the gym, right? They're good stressors. So what you're hearing when you hear people say this, I wouldn't say good stress and bad stress. There's something called allostatic load. It's just a fancy science word for stress load. You need stress that comes from exercise. So these hormones are good. The bad stress is coming from a constant inflammatory state, from bad foods, nutrient deficiencies, lack of sleep. So I wouldn't be worrying about going to the gym and working out. I would be worried about not going to the gym and working out. And to this date, I haven't met anybody, and I've worked with thousands of people. I haven't met anyone that is overtraining. But I've had one person who's overtrained, and he was a Tour de France athlete. So you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, so very little chance that the rest of us are going to overtrain. Yeah. How about high intensity? Is that important for our brains? I see so much about that everywhere too these days.
Yeah, it's important for your brains to an extent, but guess how many minutes you need of this high intensity per week? 20.
Okay.
So you don't need to be doing, you don't even need 20. You can be doing, I say 20 because there's a principle behind that, but you need more aerobic base than what you do, like high intensity training base. What we've also got to remember is when we exercise, we are engaging in a practice called cardiac remodeling. Your cardiac system, the aorta, the vessels, the arteries around the heart is a muscle as well, right? You are making it stronger. And the one thing that we want as we get older is to be able to pump as much blood as we can per contraction with less efficiency. So have you heard of resting heart rate?
Yes.
Do you know your resting heart rate?
I know what it's on my Apple Watch, like a 58, somewhere in that.
Fantastic. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The fitter you are, the healthier you are, the lower that is, right? Mine's around 46. Tour de France athletes about 38. That means that at rest, so you need a certain amount of blood to stay alive per minute, per beat. So you're basically, every time you pump out blood, every time your heart contracts, it pumps out a certain amount of blood. If you have a really strong heart with one blood, it'll pump out as much, it'll pump out a lot, right? It'll pump out a lot of blood. If it's weak, it may need two pumps to pump out the same amount of blood as a strong heart. So the stronger your heart is, the stronger the muscles around your heart and the vessels and the arteries, the less amount of times your heart needs to beat per minute. So when you are exercising, you are strengthening the heart. We don't want a resting heart rate of 70, right? You want a really low resting heart rate. And as we age, we want to keep that as low as possible if we can. So that's why we need to be engaging in aerobic-based training.
And there's a lot of research too, and we've done a podcast episode about it, about not just in terms of our cognitive issues, but mental health. We know that running can be just as effective for a lot of people as an antidepressant on warding off depression and movement and physical activity. Can you speak a little bit about that?
We are seeing so much research right now on exercise actually replacing SSRIs. We're seeing this in many different ways. We're seeing it in the psilocybin research, right? There's so many reasons to exercise, and that's because when you exercise, you release all these endorphins, you're increasing neurotransmitter activation of serotonin and dopamine, these vital neurotransmitters, these chemicals that are responsible for making you feel good, making you not feel so good. Where I think the beauty lies, though, is in resistance training, right? Resistance training does a whole other host of benefits. One thing that it does is when you contract your muscles, you release these myokines. They're muscle-based proteins. They live within the cells of the muscle. They only live there. They're not anywhere else. And when you contract your muscle, let's just say you're doing a bicep curl, you release these myokines. These myokines go into the bloodstream. They go up to your brain. They cross the blood-brain barrier and they have an effect on different areas of the brain. We've got one called irison, which was named after the Greek god Iris, and it serves as a messenger molecule. So it goes into the brain, it goes into the frontal lobe, this executive decision-making part of our brain that we need, right? This is the part of the brain that holds the prefrontal cortex. It's involved in even emotional regulation. It's not just the amygdala, guys. Like you're the CEO of your brain is the one that is actually saying to you to stop those negative thoughts when they arise and to think of something else. You need a lot of brain energy for that. Your frontal lobe is the one that's making the decisions on that. These myokines, you've got, I can name about 500 of these myokines, but you've got IL-6, you've got irisin, you've got cathepsin B. They get released from the muscles. They go into the frontal lobe of the brain, all different areas of the brain, and they switch on these different receptors and they have positive effects on the brain. So that's where I think we're seeing the positive relationship between depressive-like symptoms and mood and exercise. I'm not going to shy away from an actual clinical depression because there is definitely a case for, you know, these disorders and medication. But let me tell you, so much research is now coming out on metabolic health and its relation to mental health, especially schizophrenia and depression. Exercise improves metabolic health. What resistance training also does is you're increasing muscle mass. When you have more muscle, you A, live longer. That's the first thing. But muscle is also a storage sink for glucose. So you're improving your metabolic efficiency. And to couple that, I'll end with also saying that every time you exercise in the aerobic state or when you are improving muscle mass, you are increasing mitochondrial biogenesis. You are increasing the number of mitochondria in the muscle. More mitochondria equals more energy. More energy equals more life, better mood, better metabolic health. Therefore, you're going to have a better time regulating emotions, regulating mood, staving off depressive-like symptoms. It's just, I honestly believe that exercise is the elixir for emotional health, mental health, and longevity.
I do too, in my own life, but also in my therapy clients' lives, the people who say, you know, I started going to the gym, I started running every day, the changes that they see. And there's tons of research too on strength training and anxiety specifically. And I have to say, for people in my therapy office who struggle with anxiety, sometimes the most powerful thing they could do is just go to the gym and lift weights. And people with PTSD will often see incredible improvements when they start strength training as well.
Yeah. And not just that, you're also changing your state, right? You're getting all that blood flow. I do it for a lot of my clients. I get some of them before they actually go onto the court. I do this with, I've got some Miami Heat players. Before they go on the court, a lot of them are like anxious. They're stressed. They're thinking, oh my gosh, what if I don't do this? What if I don't make this throw? What if I don't? And I get them to do like literally a minute and a half of high intensity change of state. And they immediately feel good because when you get that rush, it's like shunting blood to your brain. You just get a release of all of these chemicals that are responsible for making you feel focused, vigilant, driven. So, yeah.
And that's another thing when somebody says, you know, I feel like I'm having a panic attack. Go sprint down the street. I guarantee when you put that into something and you start exercising really hard at high intensity, you channel all of that. When you're done, you feel a lot better.
I completely agree. I actually myself, I run now without my phone because like, you know, when you've got your phone and your earphones in your ears, you're listening to other things. And I have to tell you, it is the best form. It saved me money on therapy. It is the best form of therapy, just going out there. Even if you don't run, let your phone, like, just leave it at home and just make sure your heart rate is in that 65 to 70% zone. And I tell you, it just does wonders for you.
Ooh, I like that, to be able to do that without your phone. And then it doesn't have to be exact. We don't have to be monitoring our heart rate the entire time. Right. Yeah. I like that. Let's take a second so I can share some offers from our sponsors. Okay, we're back. The idea that we should have 10,000 steps, how much does that actually matter, 10,000 steps in a day?
There's this tribe. It's called the Hadza tribe, which is like they're very well studied by physiologists, and they go over, I think it's in Tanzania, and they go and study these guys because they're the ones that live the longest, right? And the 10,000 the 10,000 steps per day rule basically was invented just to keep Americans not sedentary, right? I live in New York City. I live in Manhattan. I'm doing around 20,000 steps a day. That's just an average day, right, for me. But it is important, but not as important as, like, you don't have to just focus on getting 10,000 steps. I would actually say that that's the minimum. I would change it to 15,000. And this comes down to, like, the work done on the Hadza tribe. So I think getting minimum of 15,000 steps per day is probably much more beneficial for you. And it's just, how can we become less sedentary? And one thing that I hear a lot, especially from an aging population, and when I say aging, I mean like 60 years plus, right? A lot of them are actually more scared of injury than exercising, but they should be more scared of sedentary lifestyle than injury, because you're probably going to get an injury from the sedentary lifestyle. So the 10,000 steps is great. I just think we need better wording around this whole thing. Like, I sit down at my desk. I did get one of those walking, I got a standing desk. I got a treadmill and I was doing that, but I wasn't outside. So I got rid of it, and I get my steps by going outside. One thing also for mental health is walking basically signals to your brain. When you're walking, right, you're signaling to your brain that you're walking forward, because our brain, you have to think about it evolutionarily. The brain was designed for two things, survive and reproduction. Now we're able to survive past 40 years old. And that's because obviously we now know how to fight off infections. So that's the biggest reason why we're able to live longer. So now we have to figure out, how did our brain survive without medications until that age? Well, it survived by always knowing, one of the parts is by knowing that you are moving forward in direction. So your brain always wants you to be moving forward, goal oriented. When you walk outside, you're getting something called like forward ambulation. So you walk outside, you've got all this nature going through, you know, passing, crossing your eyes. So it signals to your brain, hey, Louisa, this is a good thing. You are moving forward. You are moving forward in life. You are moving towards a goal. So it signals to your brain. So then when you get that, you open this motivation and dopamine loop in your brain, and you release dopamine. And we release dopamine as well from the frontal lobes of the brain, different areas of the brain as well, but we get from the frontal lobe. So when you release this chemical, it actually gets into your brain and tells you you're doing a good job, and you feel more motivated and more driven to keep going and keep going.
And that makes so much sense. When I'm struggling with something, you go for a walk, and sometimes the idea, the solution to your problem just becomes clear. You can brainstorm better. And with therapy clients, sometimes we're kind of stuck. We're sitting in the office. You go for a stroll and suddenly the conversation changes. Things start to change. We can have these deeper, better conversations. Solutions seem to be flowing better. So I highly recommend the idea of a walk too. But then also the idea, don't stop with a walk. You need much more physical activity than a leisurely stroll around the neighborhood as well.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you brought up the idea of aging. I feel like there's so much content these days about the idea that, like, if you're able to walk a mile over the age of 40, then somehow you're a miracle. People act like turning 40 is the magic age where people aren't really able to be athletic anymore. You can't do anything. Yet, it's completely possible. Can you just speak a little bit about that and aging and perhaps the fears people do have about not wanting to injure themselves?
So we do age, okay? That's we are humans. And we haven't figured, no matter how many longevity experts are out, we haven't really figured out how to live till 150 yet, okay? But people are working on that. So the one thing we need to accept is, yes, we age. But we also have to accept that we can age really rapidly or we can slow the progression of it. There's no cure to aging, but we can slow it down, right? And what I do see is that things do start to not malfunction, but go wrong slow down at age 40. We start to see a rapid decline in VO2 max. That is a measure of our cardiorespiratory fitness. And you can measure this at any age, but we do see a really big decline in that at age 40. So that means that we have to be doing everything at 40 and onwards, and even before that, to ensure that we keep our cardiorespiratory fitness. The second thing that happens is we do start to get a natural decline in certain hormones. Naturally, men will start to get a decline of around 1-2% of the male hormone testosterone, right? And that just happens, 1-2% decline each year. So they have to ensure that they are sleeping well. Around 95% of males get their testosterone released during deep sleep. So you have to make sure that you're sleeping well as you age. We see bone mineral density decreasing. We see the brain atrophying. So these things do happen. So it's about becoming smarter at age 40 and above. It doesn't mean that things, it just means that the time spent in the gym should be really precise. You know, don't just go to the gym and just hang out on your phone. Like, go to the gym for a purpose. If you are going to do your aerobic training, do it then. If you're going to be doing your strength, do it then. You have to be really precise in getting everything that matters, your stability work, your strength work. Maybe you're doing some brain exercises, neurocognitive work. You have to ensure that you're doing that. But it is not the be all and end all. I've seen people in their 70s who look better than people in their 30s. And that's because they've built up all of their aerobic capacity at younger years. One thing that I will say is if you are in your 30s and you are in your 40s, this is when the disease states actually happen, which is scary because you look at cardiovascular disease or the leading causes of death. Let's look at, I'm not going to talk about cancer. Let's look at cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. These don't just happen. They're not time-stamped in your 70s when you're actually getting that disease diagnosis. They're happening. It's taking 20 years for that to accumulate. So it takes around 20 and 30 years before you actually feel the first symptom of Alzheimer's disease, which means it's starting in your 40s and maybe even 35. So you have to make sure that you're doing all these reversing agents or slowing down agents, which is exercise, good nutrition, hydration, and sleep effectively in your 30s and 40s, which is extremely doable, so you don't lead yourself down that path.
Oh, those are good points. Because I think sometimes when people are in their 30s and 40s, they're busy with work and kids and family and all sorts of other things. And it's easy to think, I'll do all that later. So maybe we can end with you just helping us figure out if somebody's listening and they say, you know, I'm pretty sedentary. I don't have a very active life. Where do I even start? Where should I put my effort and energy in to get kicked off if I want to exercise to improve my brain health?
If you haven't started and you are completely sedentary, the good news is you're going to get way more benefits out of exercising than anybody else because your body is going to adapt to that. So that's a good thing. You just have to start. And I would start with setting yourself a benchmark of doing 15 minutes of fast-paced walking a day. As I mentioned, I live in New York City. New York City is like a grid. So there's like blocks and streets, right? There's streets and avenues. And I literally, like straight after this, I have probably a call. I've got maybe a 15-minute gap. I'm going out and I'm doing a fast-paced walk around the block and then I'll come straight back up to my apartment. Set yourself so small benchmarks so you achieve them. Remember, this dopamine loop, right? If you tell your brain, I'm going out and doing a 15-minute walk, and you go out and do it, because let me tell you, 15 minutes is not hard to achieve. Let's just say you go out and do that 15-minute. If you achieve that, you are going to send a signal to your brain that you achieved something, you did something good, and it's going to motivate you to do it the next day. The biggest reason why people don't achieve their fitness goals, why they stay sedentary, is because they set these huge, audacious goals that they're not going to hit. You know you're not going to hit it. I would love to do the New York City Marathon, but I'm not going to set myself up for failure. I don't have time to train for it. It's coming up in a few, I don't know, 6, 8 months, whatever it is. I don't have time to train for it. So I'm not going to tell myself that I'm going to do it, because when the time comes and I don't do it, I'm going to hate myself. So I would rather set myself maybe a 10-kilometer run. That's more achievable for me. So set small goals and do it. And then second thing is, I really think if you have the money, the time, invest in a trainer. It doesn't have to be an expense. Maybe just someone just to teach you, maybe just do 3 sessions, because you don't, if you are sedentary, that means that you probably don't know how to use weights. And if you don't know correct technique, and I go to the gym every day, I see so many people in there, I don't even know what they're doing. I'm like, you're just wasting your time. But I don't have patience to go and talk to everybody at the gym, and I don't think they'd appreciate it. But I do see a lot of people in there, especially women, lifting small weights. I would say invest in a trainer if you don't know what you're doing, and just start weight training, even if you're doing a 20-minute weight training session. That would pay dividends on your performance goals. And then you can go from 20 minutes to 30 minutes. Just start small and work your way up.
I agree, and I second the idea of hiring a trainer. I did for 1 month, and it absolutely changed everything for me. So if people want to learn more about you, Louisa, where's the best place for them to go?
I hang out a lot on Instagram, Louisa Nicola. I have a podcast as well, which you featured on it, The Neuro Experience. Those two places, you'll see me quite active and quite vocal in what I believe.
You are, and I have been a fan of you for, I don't know how many years now, many, many years. Always appreciate your wisdom and thrilled that we finally got you on my podcast. And we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for sharing some of your knowledge with us today, but I hope our listeners all go follow you on Instagram and check out your podcast so they can gain a lot more of your wise words over the years.
Thank you so much, Amy. It was fun. And likewise, you are absolutely phenomenal. What you're doing is incredible. And I'm so thankful that you asked me to be on your show.
Oh, well, thanks for being here. Welcome to The Therapist Take, where I'll give you my take on Louisa's strategies and share how you can apply them to your life today. Here are 3 of my favorite strategies that she shared. 1, get your blood work done. When people come into my therapy office, whether they're experiencing depression or they're having trouble sleeping, one of the first things we usually do is make sure that they've had a recent physical, complete with blood work. A lot of physical health issues can lead to mental health symptoms, and we want to rule those things out before we try talk therapy. Like a thyroid issue, for example, often leads to depression. If you haven't gotten lab work done in a while, it's a great idea. Ask your doctor and then ask for the detailed results. And you might find that you're able to Google things and look things up for yourself to get a better understanding of what all of those lab results mean. 2, get 60 minutes of vigorous physical activity 3 or 4 days a week. You probably hear a lot of people recommending your exercise get broken up into small chunks of time, like just walk for 5 minutes here and 10 minutes there, and it all adds up. And while Louisa says she does get a lot of exercise in small chunks like that, like when she walks around the block between meetings, she says exercising for an hour at a time is essential to our brains. But I know that that's tough. It's tough to find a whole hour of time to actually work out, and it feels too taxing. Like, who can really run for a whole hour straight? But listening to her say that actually motivated me to say maybe I should go on more longer runs. This is one area that I could work on for sure, but I'd have to learn how to pace myself. If you listen to the show, you know I like to run fast, not necessarily far. But it doesn't have to be running either. Pick something that you enjoy. No matter what it is, you're much more likely to stick to it for the long haul if you find it fun. So whether you like riding your bike or swimming or doing something else, see if you can do it for an hour four times a week. And there are lots of ways to monitor your physical activity and learn more about your body, including wearable tech. Whether you have an Apple Watch or you just use your smartphone to get more information about how many steps you're taking or what your resting heart rate is, there are so many simple ways to do it these days without having to put in much effort. And just doing that can give you a baseline of where you are and how much movement you're getting. And number three, do 4 strength training sessions per week. There are lots of benefits of lifting weights for both your brain and your body. And you don't necessarily have to go to the gym to do it. Buy some dumbbells and work out at home. Research exercises that you can do online. And if you hire a trainer, even for just a few sessions, they can help you create a program and make sure that you're using correct form. But if you can't afford a trainer, don't let that stop you. Look up online workouts and follow along with them. So remember that working out isn't always just about looking good or only improving your physical health. It's also an important exercise for improving your mental health. So those are 3 of Louise's tips that I highly recommend if you want to use exercise to also build mental strength. Get your blood work done. Get 60 minutes of vigorous physical activity 3 or 4 days a week. And do 4 strength training sessions per week. Thank you for hanging out with me today and for listening to the Mentally Stronger podcast. If you like the show, leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. That's one of the best ways to help us get our show in front of other people so we can make the world a stronger place. If you know somebody who could benefit from learning more about mental strength, share the show with them. Simply sharing a link to this episode could help someone feel better and grow stronger. And if you want even more tips on how to build mental strength, subscribe to Mentally Stronger Premium. You'll get weekly bonus episodes and exclusive extras, including things like signed books from me, by becoming a premium subscriber. Sign up at mentallystronger.supercast.com or just click on the link in the show notes. And as always, a big thank you to my show's producer, who subscribed to MLBTV.com for us so we can watch baseball in the podcast studio again this year, Nick Valentine.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a #1 entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's #1 negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs, Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.